It gives me great pleasure to welcome everyone here today to the University of South Australia. I'm Erica Green, the Director of the University Samstag Museum. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this event is taking place on Kaurna land and pay my respects to the living culture of the Kaurna people and the unique role they play in the life of the Adelaide region. It also gives me tremendous pleasure to welcome you all today to the Double Helix Art and the Moving Image Symposium presented by the Big Pond Adelaide Film Festival. The Samstag Museum is delighted to be hosting this important event, and our involvement has grown from our successful collaboration with the Film Festival in producing the Lynette Walworth Duality of Light exhibition, which you can see presented downstairs in the Samstag Museum, and it'll be open at lunch today. Those of you who were here last night were very fortunate to hear the distinguished Mexican-Canadian artist Rafael Lozano Hema launch the symposium as our first keynote speaker. It was a marvellous, informative and friendly evening that I think was immensely enjoyed by everyone. Today we're very pleased to welcome a most distinguished lineup of speakers, commencing shortly with Lawrence Kardish, who is the Senior Curator, Department of Film and Media at the Museum of Modern Art, New York. I also extend a special welcome to all our symposium speakers. Should you have any queries about the lectures or venue, please ask staff in the foyer. And just so you know, the air conditioning is on. It just takes a little while to kick in, so hopefully you'll start cooling down. The symposium has been curated by Julianne Pierce. I'd like to once again congratulate Julianne and the Film Festival team for their crucial hard work, particularly Adele Hahn and, of course, Katrina Sedgwick, as well as my own staff from the Samstag Museum, who are responsible for enormous efforts behind the scenes, Sarah Wall, Jane Wicks, and our hardworking volunteer, Colin Moglia. I hope you enjoy this fantastic program of talks and conversations and the exceptional list of speakers and participants. What a treat. It now gives me great pleasure to ask Julianne Pierce to introduce our keynote speaker today, Lawrence Kardish. Thanks, Julianne.
Thanks, Erica, and welcome, everyone. I'm great to see you here this morning. I'd really like to thank Erica and the team at Samstag Museum for working with myself and the Big Pond Adelaide Film Festival on this symposium. It's been a pleasure to work with such a fantastic team, and I'd really like to acknowledge the work that Katrina Sedgwick and Adele Hahn do in bringing in other strands into this very special film festival. And last night we had a fantastic presentation from Rafael, which really started to bring out some of these issues about the relationship between cinema, moving image and interactivity. So we do have a very full day. We have some really fabulous guests speaking today, and I'm sure that it's going to be a very rigorous and interesting debate throughout the day. And also tomorrow we have a special presentation of the Dome Project, which is a project that Australian Network for Art and Technology have brought here to Adelaide. And if you haven't picked up a program, we have a leaflet of the full program here. So it's my real pleasure now to introduce Larry Kardish, who is the Senior Film Curator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Larry has organised hundreds of exhibitions, coordinated annual presentations of new cinema from Germany and Canada, and since its inception in 1972, served on the selection committee of the New Directors New Films Festival, coordinated in partnership with the Film Society of Lincoln Centre. And Larry is here as the jury president of the Natuzzi film competition. So Larry's been seeing lots of films, and we really appreciate that he's made this window in his schedule to make a presentation to us today. So please welcome Larry, and followed by Larry's presentation, there'll be a question and answer session led by Catherine Weir from Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane. So over to Larry. Thank you.
Thank you and good morning. I first want to thank the Big Pond Adelaide Film Festival and Double Helix Art and the Moving Image Program for inviting me to be one on the film jury and to give this this discursive talk this morning. I'm particularly grateful to Katrina Sedgwick, Adele Hahn, and Julianne Pierce, the guest curator of Double Helix, for their consideration. I've entitled my talk, More Than Less, Moving Images and MoMA, Some Arguments And the talk will be rather informal and, like our collection at MoMA, very much in process. And while I speak, I'm going to be screening some stills from the Moving Image Works film, video, and installation pieces in MoMA's collection. These are pieces that were acquired through 2005, so I will not be showing you a still from a recent acquisition about which we're very proud, Isaac Julian's feature-length documentary, Derek, which is shown both in cinemas and in galleries, was at the Serpentine Gallery in London, and on television, multiple deliveries of one work, which is part of the problematics I will be speaking about. While I'm speaking, you'll see these images because we have this new literacy, our multi-image on one screen lives, which has been afforded to us through the watching of foreign language films, but more importantly through the films that we see on our PC, where there are multiple scripts and multiple images working on the same screen at the same time, and by watching, particularly in the States, news broadcasts with many types of scripts that are running simultaneously. I had an experience recently, a conversation with Michael Barker, who is one of the co-presidents of Sony Pictures Classics, which is one of the great distributors of independent and foreign language films in the U.S., and he was saying that he doesn't despair of screening foreign language films anymore because audiences, both of my generation that grew up with foreign language films and those under 30, are used to reading text while watching images. Nevertheless, it does seem that distributors still resist showing subtitled works. I'm now organizing an exhibition in New York, which opens at the beginning of May, of the Dutch media artist Arnott Mick, whose work some of you might know, particularly if you traveled to the last Venice Biennale, where he occupied the Dutch pavilion. This exhibition, and these are some images, this is the last of the images of his, from his work. This exhibition is exciting for me because other than an installation by Elisa Attila of a work called Home, which I organized for what was then called the Media Gallery at MoMA, I have never, given my focus on film, been able to organize an exhibition which will take place outside the theater in several public spaces throughout the museum. Some of Arnott's work will be shown in galleries, but most will be interventions in public spaces. I'm able to do this exhibition because, given the present fluidity, plasticity, and understanding of contemporary art practice, the museum has invited me to do this, and his work demands this as well. I claim Arnott Mick as an artist, as a filmmaker, but the artist avers this description. He thinks of himself as a sculptor, an architect, a sociologist, an ethnographer. But he did not necessarily see himself as merely a filmmaker, and he isn't. However, Arnott Mick does make films, in the non-analog sense, that partially fill or occupy the walls and rooms that he constructs to hold these moving images. He, like many great filmmakers, never had any formal training, but he understands the rhythm, spacing, the landscape, the editing, and mystery of filmmaking. The film part of Arnott's work looks like the work, or reminds me of the work, of the great Hungarian filmmaker Miklós Jancsó, who was an influence on his younger countryman, Béla Tarr, without whom Gus Van Sant has said he could never have made Elephant, which is the one film that Arnott Mick cites. So there is kind of a continuing sensibility there. In any case, this is all in the way of an introduction to the idea of some of the arguments that film and new media and video have within the museum. As kind of an ancillary part of this Arnott Mick exhibition, I've convened a panel. And I have, on the panel, I have a film critic who is sympathetic to the idea of cinema outside the cinema, an art critic who has welcomed the moving image or cinema into the gallery, and a curator who's at the junction of both. The curator I've invited is Donna DeSalvo, who is the chief curator of art at the Whitney Museum of American Art. And she said she wanted to speak about the problematics of film in the gallery. And I took I latched onto this notion of problematics and an argument for the following reason. The Museum of Modern Art has always embraced the notion of problematic and argument in talking about the development of contemporary art. We'll go back for a little history. In 1929, when three women of privilege, Miss Lily P. Bliss, Mrs. Cornelius J. Sullivan, and Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Jr., approached Alfred H. Barr, Jr. to head this new institution, and like all institutions, museums in New York State were chartered as educational institutions. This new educational institution, which at that time was just a few rooms in an office building, Alfred Barr agreed to head this new institution with the understanding, and the goal was modest even then, to become the greatest museum of modern art in the world, that he agreed so long as the preeminent art of the 20th century, film, which was then about 40 years old, would be included to be collected, exhibited, studied, cataloged, and enjoyed as any of the other arts were at that time. But even then there were certain problematics, given that there was no place to screen films in 1929 in that office building. In fact, our theater was not built until 1939. And also given that the Museum of Modern Art opened its door in November of 1929, after the stock market crash of the month before, there was no money with which to acquire these films. However, the museum has always maintained in its mission statement that there will be new forms of artistic expression yet to be developed and understood. And these forms are open-ended series of arguments. And so I'm taking this notion of argument to present a number of the problematics. And this is even evident in the name of our department. In 1935, we became the film library of the Museum of Modern Art. In the early 60s, we became the Department of Film. In the 1970s, we became the Department of Film and Video. In the 90s, we became the Department of Film and Media. And in the aughts, we reverted to the Department of Film because we had established at the museum a separate Department of Media, which only a month ago became the Department of Media and Performance Art, leaving me to wonder what the difference is between performance art and that performing art for which the late Heath Ledger won his Academy Award last weekend. So the more we define our activities, the more questions that are raised, there are more arguments that could be made. And I'm going to isolate a few. What is film? Film to me and to those in our department was, well, once film was simply a translucent strip of celluloid on which there was a fixed photographic emulsion. On the strip were hundreds of discrete photographic images that, when run through a projector with a beam of light shining through this translucent material, projected images onto a screen that the images perceived as moving. Film today is no longer this beautiful, nay, sublime analog medium or experience. It is also an electronic one. Film, thanks to artistic nomenclature, we follow the artist's vision. If the artist says he's making a film or she's making a film, film it is. Although codec has nothing to do with it. And it's a film, whether it is a film, which is less and less, or a videotape, or a digibeta, or an HD cam, or even a program on a hard drive. No matter what it is, it really does exist. It does not exist apart from the audience's perception of it. In other words, the strip of celluloid, the magnetic shavings on the tape, the grid that is read by the computer's drive to become information to be projected off the server, is not the work of art itself, but rather the necessary and essential strata from which the experience derives. The problems obtain in collecting, archiving, and presenting these strata or noumena. Each one requires a different set of coordinates, a different team of operators who have to learn how to screen this material, and curators fluent in the understanding of how these media work. I know that in the 70s, I really personally resisted calling any work on video a film because I was being a purist and wanted to stick to film as being something that was simply chemically based. And actually, most of the videos at that time were shown on monitors and not projected in public spaces. Nevertheless, artists fascinated, intrigued, and wanting to make movies called their videos films, referring to the perception of these rather than their substance. And so film has become part of this expanded language, and their signification all the more embracing. This year, the Sundance Film Festival passed a historic mark. For the first time in its quarter century, it screened more works on tape than on film, in quotation marks. And we now at MoMA regard film not only as 35mm, 16mm, and Super 8, but also as a variety of electronic media. And of course, one of our most recent acquisitions that I spoke about earlier, Isaac Julian's Derek, is about a filmmaker, is not on film at all. Second question, is it a film if it's for an audience of one? The first films were those made for Edison kinetoscopes in the States in the 1890s. They could be seen by one person. They were seen as a peep show machine. But in the kinetoscope parlors, there were rows upon rows of these devices, many of them showing the same 30 seconds of film. So theoretically, people can simultaneously but individually experience the same moving images. Perhaps this anticipates 2009, when the majority of films are seen by one person on his or her laptop. But then again, if the image is being streamed, the presumption is that many can see the work at the same time, but individually. To me, although the genesis of the film experience was one-on-one, I'd always thought of film as a communal experience. We have heard and read many times about the metaphor of film as some kind of communal liturgy, a profane church, a shared experience, a public dream. But even in experiencing film as a one-on-one, the kinetoscope viewer was aware of others viewing the material as well. Or the laptop recipient knows that the work being viewed is also being viewed by others. Sharing the experience, even in isolation, seems to be part of cinema. However, you have to leave it to that subversive genius, Jean-Luc Godard, to upset this apple cart. I bring this up because I organized a Godard retrospective in the very early 90s. And Jean-Luc was looking for funding for his next film. And he came to me with what I thought was an outrageous proposition. Godard wanted to make films, and he wanted to earn a living. He saw himself as an artist, and not necessarily a participant in an industry. And this was his proposal. Would I identify for him one of MoMA's trustees? And in the U.S., most, not all, trustees of museums and cultural organizations are major donors to these institutions. Would I identify for him one of our wealthiest trustees? And would I make an initial approach for Jean-Luc to ask this trustee for about $1 million? Godard would make a film, that is a video, and this for this trustee. And this trustee could do with it what he or she would do. Make it available to others, accessible to others, keep it for himself or herself to show in the privacy of his own room, or even auction it off. I thought what an intriguing, but given my predilection for accessibility, a hideous idea. But little did I know this would sort of come to pass, and this leads us to the idea of additioning. Okay, we're not speaking of installation or site-specific work, but films that can be viewed or experienced in either a theater or on a gallery wall. A moving image, single or double screen work with duration, whether it's Matthew Barney's Cream Master, Ayelisa Attila's Love is a Treasure, any number of William Kentridge's animations that don't depend on the accompanying drawings, or Nikki Lee's films, or Laurel Nakadati, a new American artist who is now represented by a gallery. Godard was speaking of making a commissioned work with an edition of one, and I must admit that we never got around to the other point, who would get the negative? Did the artist keep this, or would this be given to the buyer collector? Of course, in the industry of film or cinema, the negative belongs to the producer or the group that funded the film. In the art world, this was not so. The work might be purchased by a collector or an institution, but the original material remains with the artist. However, this can also pose a problem as well. Many galleries encourage their artists who make films to have them editioned, say, to make only 4 35mm prints or 4 digibetas or 4 HD cams or 4 hard drives, which would be available for purchase for either private enjoyment or institutional exhibition. And the prices for these pieces are elevated, advanced, high, and unlike the usual cost of a DVD, because they are not made available to everyone, they are expensive. Some artists' work are made available in both limited quantities and unlimited publication, which makes the buyer of the limited edition wary, unless something special, unique, and specific is attached to that purchase, in which case it's that particular thing which renders the work valuable and not the work in and of itself. Also, I still have a problem with that because I think film is eminently and should be eminently duplicatable. At the Museum of Modern Art, we recently bought a 35mm limited edition film by a major contemporary artist. I resisted paying the higher price, but agreed to because I thought, and so did the trustees who acquired the piece, because I thought the Museum of Modern Art should have this piece, for which only 4 35mm copies were made for major museums. But this did not mean the general public could not buy inexpensive DVDs of this piece, which came out later. And of course, DVDs are not 35mm prints, but I don't know if I would today recommend any such purchase at the price we agreed upon, in spite of my enthusiasm for this piece, given the accessibility of it generally. This is not to say I wouldn't want to have a good 35mm print of a film. It's just that I would not be so eager to recommend purchase at the elevated price. The other issue is that with film, and I'm only talking about the medium of film, the analog medium of film, no matter how good the projection is, its exhibition diminishes it physically. Gradually, often sooner than later, the film has to be replaced. And to replace a film, you need an original. If you're going to edition a film, it's not like editioning a drawing, a print of a drawing or a photograph. You would not destroy the original negative. That would be criminal. You wouldn't destroy the original to maintain the integrity of the edition. So who gets to keep the original? Well, the artist. But the nature of film conservation and preservation is so particular, it is not always wise not to have the original material stored in some formal archive. In the case of the film that we acquired recently, the negative to that work exists in a national film archive. The filmmaker's country of origin is storing the negative of that film, and that archive is a member of the International Federation of Film Archives, of which MoMA was a founding member. So we know it's going to be in good hands. So whenever this film is... we can't use it anymore because we've shown it so often and it's scratched and it's not in a condition that we would want to screen, we could go to the National Film Archive that holds the negative and buy another print at duplicating cost. So not the advanced cost, but the duplicating cost. We also have to return the worn print to the artist. There are a number of galleries in New York and a number of artists in New York who work on 16mm. I mean, the artists are from all over the world, but their galleries in New York would supply any buyer with an exhibition copy of a film and an internegative, so that you could make your own prints from the negative. That's another way of solving that problem. Additioning, although it is good for the artist, has complicated matters somewhat for us at the Museum of Modern Art. In fact, we recently acquired some brand new short pieces by young filmmakers from around the world, from various countries, and often we're the first purchase for the artist. We cannot, as a matter of principle, name a price for a piece that that we'll acquire. We have to ask the artist what he or she wants, and then we say, well, that's a reasonable amount. We can present this to our trustees, or this might be too high, or you know. But we cannot come in with a figure at first to say, we'll pay you X amount for this piece. But because so many works are now editioned, I have to when I make a proposal to our trustees, because the curators at the museum can recommend purchase of works. The trustees who are involved with the various departments of the museum will agree, yes, we can acquire this or not acquire this, whether it's a gift or a purchase. But when I'm saying I'd like to buy X film, the question that the trustees ask me is, what's the edition? This is a new question. This has never happened before because films were not editioned. They were just part of public discourse and part of an industry. So I have to ask the artist, what is the edition? Sometimes the artist or the filmmaker is absolutely stupefied to have this question. They said, well, what do you mean? And then I have to explain what gallery practice is. And so you have filmmakers, first-time filmmakers, who I have to give the idea of editioning to. Not that I'm recommending that or not. So it becomes quite perplexing. And sometimes, you know, since I know and since most of us at the museum know the gallerists in New York, and if a gallerist knows that one of us, one of the curators, likes a certain artist, they may call us up and say, should I encourage my artist to edition the work or not? And it's a very peculiar situation, because if you don't edition a work, say, it can show at film festivals and win awards, you know, like Steve McQueen's Hunger. Here's a guy who made a feature-length film. It's not going to be editioned. It went to Cannes. It got a major award and will continue to receive accolades. So editioning really does become a curious issue in this new world. But speaking of Steve McQueen, I want to talk about Problematic Four. Is a filmmaker an artist? My answer, of course, is yes. But there's another British artist, Tacita Dean, who I think makes terrific work. Some of it cinema, and we have acquired at the museum her Sun Quartet. We're the only institution in the world to have her four films about the sun. None of the four films will ever be shown in a theater. They're all to be shown in particular gallery configurations. But Tacita made a film recently called The Uncles. It's a documentary. I have a particular affection for it because I'm in it. I interview Tacita's uncles. Tacita Dean, this is another aside, but Tacita Dean has two uncles. She is related to two major families of British film history. It turns out that Tacita's father is the son of the British film pioneer Basil Dean, who is the founder of what became Elstree Studios. And his elder brother, of course, is Tacita's uncle. While Tacita's mother's sister is married to Johnny, who's the son of Michael Balkin, who took over Elstree from Basil Dean and made it world famous for British comedy. But when he took it over from Basil Dean, there were two generations, and there was some enmity between the family. But Tacita was very fond of her two uncles, Michael Balkin's son and her father's brother, and she wanted them to be interviewed together, and she asked me to do this. And she made a beautiful anamorphic cinemascope 16-millimeter film, which is kind of 16-millimeter anamorphic is not the easiest medium to show. But she wasn't going to audition it because it wasn't art. And I've had an argument, and when I adore Tacit, and we still have this argument, that it is art, because there's nothing that she could make that isn't art, given that she is an artist. But it was kind of revolutionary in 1929 when the museum was founded to say filmmakers were artists. Of course, there were filmmakers like Fernand Léger and Man Ray and Paul Strand who made films who had already established their reputation as visual artists at other and other media. But when the museum was established, Iris Barry, who was the world's first film curator, a founder of the London Film Society, who became the head of MoMA's film library, she went to many, many places, including Hollywood, with John Hay Whitney. John Hay Whitney was an early museum trustee, an avid polo player, a very wealthy young man, who, in addition to collecting modern painting, was an enthusiast in film. He was one of the investors in Technicolor. He was in partnership with David O. Selznick in Hollywood and had to do with the making of Gone with the Wind. And he was the appropriate choice to be the first chairman of the museum's film library, which he was from 1935 to 1951. Whitney knew our collection could only be assembled by those who made the movies themselves. And he sent Iris Barry to Hollywood to persuade industry leaders to donate prints, which was a radical concept that startled stars and producers alike. At a reception in the Pickfair Mansion, that's the mansion that Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks had, Iris Barry illustrated film's brief but important history demonstrating the fragility of the medium. She argued that it needed to be safeguarded. She screened the 1903 Great Train Robbery, Chaplin's Gold Rush, as well as a new film from 1935, a Technicolor Walt Disney cartoon, Pluto's Judgment Day, which is very difficult to see these days because of its racial stereotypes. Soon responding with donations were Warner Brothers, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, among others. The one person she didn't get originally was D.W. Griffith, who is arguably the most important American filmmaker who developed a film language for American narrative cinema. He couldn't believe that he was an artist, even though everyone today, there's no question, he was kind of the Picasso of the medium. And it was only when he became financially quite needy that he agreed to allow the museum to purchase his collection and was happy about that. But Iris Barry and Alfred Barr also went to Moscow, Paris, and London and collected films by Fritz Lang and Eisenstein and Pudovkin to make the basis of our collection. And with that was the idea that there were certain directors who worked with a consistent style. This was before the auteur theory was articulated. But the curators then realized that there was an art form and that the person most responsible was the director, in most cases, because some of the earliest acquisitions were because of the performance, including the most controversial at the time was Mae West. And that's why the museum has a number of Mae West films, whom I guess it could be argued was an early performance artist. Her persona was her performance. And perhaps that was my answer to the question I asked myself earlier, the difference between Heath Ledger, say, and Marina Abramovitz. We also have in our collection now living and active popular American filmmakers like Clint Eastwood, Oliver Stone, Martin Scorsese, Woody Allen, David O. Russell, Sofia Coppola, Alexander Payne, the Coen brothers, and the not-so-living but very much alive Andy Warhol, all of whom are represented extensively in the collection. A favorite story of mine in this regard about filmmakers, artist filmmakers, concerns to me the American avant-garde filmmaker and that supreme artist, Stan Brakhage, who died leaving an enormously rich legacy, many films. He was a pioneering visionary, and he made hundreds of 16-millimeter works, and some of the works he made were originals. He painted on film so that it was nothing was exposed. It was just the originals, his paint on clear celluloid. And these objects, would be destroyed in the very act of projection. I'm pleased to say that MoMA has a collection of each one of his films for which there are negatives, and a number of his paint on films original, and they provide and they present a problem in terms of preservation and exhibition. We will make negatives of those, but this is not the issue. The issue is that many years ago, Stan tried to copyright his films to protect them. And he began adding the C with a circle in the year of making on them. And he got a note from the Library of Congress saying, you can't do this. You can't copyright your work. And he said, why can't I copyright my work? And the library said, because you can only copyright an expression of an idea. And how do you articulate an idea that consists of light flashes, color fields, scratches? How do you articulate this? Stan was incensed, and we were at the museum were as well, because the library argued, like, you don't have to copyright a painting because the painting is a unique object, and any copy is kind of a forgery. But Stan said, okay, but I have, say 30 prints of each of my films, and if they're not copyright, anyone could show them. Anyone can make money off of them, unlikely, but that's, and so I do want to protect myself. Finally, the library caved in, and his works are all copyright. But the idea that it couldn't be for a while because no one could articulate what they were about is fascinating. Just by the way, a film that I highly recommend of his, to me, one of his masterworks, is a feature-length work called The Text of Light, which is quite simply and beautifully 70 minutes of light reflected through and refracted by a glass ashtray. Stan was a member of the New American Cinema Group, a group that was founded by, among others, Jonas Mekas and Shirley Clarke in the mid-60s in New York. And it is through Shirley we come to our kind of the last problematic in a most general way, which I call duration and dimension. It's talking about cinema out of the box and film without film, paring down film to its essentials, to what is its ontology. Does movement and duration make a film? Of course not, because movement and duration can also be applied to theater or dance. But what is it that defines film? I think it has to do with light and two dimensions. Although I think that the film's power is such that depth is always suggested. What happens, though, when depth is incorporated into the experience of cinema? Well, in a certain sense, it always is, because the viewer is always aware of what is around him or her. The film experience necessarily happens in three dimensions, because that's the world we viewers and thinkers inhabit, and that's the way our mind constructs images. But I want to take a look at what Shirley Clarke did in the shift from film analog to video, video as a measurer of deep space. Shirley Clarke came to cinema from dance. She was inspired by an earlier filmmaker who is now known as the mother of the American avant-garde cinema, Maya Deren. Both women were elated by the possibility of editing that provided a dancer with the ability to begin a jump or twirl in one location and through editing physically end that jump or twirl in another distant location. Shirley, first of all, made dance films, but her first theatrical feature was very different in that she explored one room, a particular physical space, in her cinematic version of Jack Gelber's claustrophobic play, The Connection. about ostensibly some white junkies waiting for a fix from a black dealer. From the connection, which was in which he moved the camera rather elegantly in this enclosed space, she made one of the best films about young African Americans in Harlem, The Cool World, almost a documentary film. It was funded by, interesting enough, Frederick Weissman before he made his first documentary films. And then as her final feature, Shirley made a film called The Portrait of Jason, which was a black and white feature-length interview, only Jason's on screen, with a very witty black male hustler, facing, speaking to the camera, engaging the audience with his intelligence and his perceptions of life. But it's as minimal as one could get. And all this had to do, again, with space. This space was even more confined than the connection. But Shirley was intrigued by space, but she was also becoming fascinated by the possibilities of video. And it's interesting that she didn't make Portrait of Jason in video, because video wasn't sophisticated enough allow her to create what she did with film at the time. But in 1971, I approached Shirley to do a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art, a film retrospective. And she very reluctantly agreed because she said she was moving away from film and she wanted to kind of celebrate this new technology. And she said, okay, if you allow me to kind of devise my opening night, we could do it. And I wanted to show her films. And so her opening night was that she had an apartment on the roof of the Chelsea Hotel. And she obliged us to move most of the furniture from her apartment to the stage at MoMA. And she also had about 7 or 8 television monitors on stage. And she also had 7 or 8 video cameras. And her opening night was simply handing out video cameras to the audience and suggesting they go into the lobby and shoot themselves, and then the images you would see on the monitors. That was it. It had no duration except her own. When Shirley thought it was time to finish, she would, you know, the evening would be finished. But it was extraordinarily frustrating to all those people who came to see a film to somehow be in charge of the experience of. But Shirley was really intrigued with the notion of simultaneity. Not using video as a recording device, but as a means of presenting images of activities that were happening in other spaces and other times, going back to her dance background. And it's interesting that some of the earliest video artists that we have was interested in this aspect of video presentation, simultaneity and moving and playing with space in some sort of simultaneous and instantaneous way. The first works of Peter Campos, for instance, and then even Shigeko Kubota and Marcel Odenbach. And we had our video curator there, Barbara London, who was able to acquire a lot of the early video work. Some of which, of course, is now has its own problems in terms of preservation, because there are a certain type of videotapes that no longer exist and can't be shown on monitors that no longer exist. Even recently, we had a commission of Chris Marker. Chris Marker made a piece for us, and it is supposed to be shown on 6 to 12 monitors on a bank. But the monitors for which he made these pieces, in a particular aspect ratio, you know, length, height to width, are no longer made. So he has to reformat his imagery in order to accommodate what's happened with the making of monitors. Chrissy Isles from the Whitney Museum wrote in her marvelous catalog for her marvelous exhibition, Projected Image in American Art, 1964 to 1977, that in the early 70s, and she's right, so I'm quoting her, that's right. In the early 70s, the projected image played a critical role in creating a new language of representation as artists used film, slides, video, and holographic and photographic projection to measure, document, abstract, reflect, and transform the physical parameters of space. I think one of the most elegant and spectacular examples of this was Anthony McCall's line describing a cone, which added a third dimension, got rid of the flatness, and yet it kept the notion of film, of cinema. Line describing a cone, if you want to show it, what is needed is a 16-millimeter projector in a room and the film that Anthony McCall made, the 16-millimeter film that begins with no image, but then there's a dot. The dot grows into a line. The line grows into an arc. The arc grows into a cone. However, the viewer is not invited to watch this transformation of dot to cone on a screen because there's no screen. The 16-millimeter projector throws a beam of light defined by the dot line arc cone transformation into the air, into the open space of an enclosed room. And it is that transformation of the light beam that becomes the beautiful object of interest, hence a cinematic experience. And this beam can be walked through. So while the beam is not precisely a physical object, it is a presence, something with dimension, dependent on the motion picture film creating it. In order to better see the beam arc, a device is now arranged to provide a mist or light fog in the room through which the light beam cuts. When I first presented this work at the Museum of Modern Art in the early 70s, how times change, we distributed cigarettes to everybody, inviting the viewers to blow directly into the path of light emanating from the projector. This work was truly interactive. We acquired this film shortly after its presentation at MoMA, but for reasons of health and fire code, we can no longer present it in its original format. Since McCall's piece, we have experienced, of course, many variations on the notion of cinema and space. And a most recent one, which I found particularly exciting, and which I saw in Paris, and which I might suggest for acquisition, is a work by Marc Geffriot, a 2008 work called Polka Dot. You come into a room that's filled with photograph, newspapers, collage, drawings. The room darkens, and it looks like a jumble, all these papers. And the room darkens, and a motorized light that is on a base, but revolves, it's an oval light, starts, you're standing in the room, and you watch as the light transverses the room, picking out only certain aspects of the pieces that are hung on the walls, and kind of a narrative emerges. And I think it's a very neat piece that combines a cinematic aspect and space as well. Okay, just before I conclude, just a couple of statistics. Our collection of film and video and moving image work is housed in an archive about 100 miles away from the Museum of Modern Art in Pennsylvania. It's a state-of-the-art preservation facility built 10 years ago with the support of one single trustee, Celeste Bartos, because, as you know, that there's very little government support of the arts in the U.S., and so almost everything comes through philanthropy and membership. We do not have any labs on our premises, but we work with very good labs all across the country. For our acquisitions and preservations, we again get very little funding from the government, but we work with our trustees and with private foundations, whether it's the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences or Women in Film and Television or the Warhol Foundation. We actually do all the preservation work on Warhol's films, so we have negatives and prints of virtually everything, although this is an ongoing process. The Warhol Foundation and the Warhol Museum owns the copyright on these. So those are just some of the ideas, and if you have any questions, I thank you.
Thanks very much for that presentation, which really took us across. Is that working, the microphone? A lot of issues in the defining and collecting of the mediums of film, video, and installation works. I'm really just here to open it up for, we have about a quarter of an hour for a discussion session. and I think you've
touched... Oh, this is a work we just passed. I just wanted to... for our Arnott Mick exhibition, we were able to commission a work, and that's that image of the young people at the Shah d'Ors is part of the work that will have its world premiere at MoMA. Do you say world premiere or the first screening at MoMA? You see how the language is in May? It's a double screen work called Schoolyard. Okay, I'm sorry, continue.
Oh, great. I think Mick is quite an interesting point for kicking off with one line of discussion, which is about the specialization of work. You referred to your ongoing discussion with Arnott Mick about what defines his work. Mick speaks about it often in terms of architecture, creating particular embodied spaces for the viewer. Mm-hmm. These are, for those of you who haven't been inside these installations, often multiple screen projections within a particular configuration of walls that, you know, you may be within a projection on a zigzag on both sides of you. The figures are often around life size. You're very aware of yourself in the space. And the durational aspect is something that Mick also treats in a very particular way. He doesn't like to talk about the duration of his works because they are continuous loops that are meant to be experienced seamlessly. So
that's right. And in doing the catalog, I knew what the answer was. I had to ask him, do you want to publish the running times of these? And he knew he'd say no. And I'm glad he said no. So, yes.
Exactly. So then I think it would be interesting to hear you talk a little more about Mick and how he sees his practice in relation to how, at the end of your talk, you defined film as this moving between these vectors of the materialization of light and two dimensions, and whether either Mick or someone like Tacita Dean, who insists that the 16mm projector with the looper be in the space as part of something that becomes quite sculptural. She wouldn't show her 16mm films in a cinema situation. How are you thinking about two dimensions in relation to these works as a definer?
Well, I think that one of the things that has intrigued me as a curator is the adding the third dimension in cinema. And I think Mick does this because you have to, in order to appreciate his work, you kind of have to walk around it. And you have to be necessarily aware, not as you said, not only of yourself, but of the other viewers. And with Tacita, she wants the projector to be a physical presence, the sound and the sight of it. So just the distance between the projector and the and the screen provides that that dimension. What I find sometimes peculiar in some of the recent work are the artists who insist on building a cinema, a particular cinema for their work, so that even though the artist says you can't show the work in your theaters at the Museum of Modern Art, but you have to build a theater for me because they want the particular dimensions. That becomes somewhat problematic as well. We'll do it, but it's
again in some of those cases, Tobias Petrie's work, not Alston. Those cinemas really are sculptural elements. Tobias is working with particular materials, creating wooden cinemas that work with light. With his installation in Venice a couple of years ago on an island, in the daytime the wooden panels were slightly translucent and you had this very particular experience of that as a sculptural space, and then at night he curated a script film program to be presented within that sculpture. So this really completely blows apart any opposition between black box, white box. It's just so much more differentiated and interesting in a way the requirements to respond to artists' practice and what's being done with the moving image. Another point I think would be interesting to return to is the materialization of light, also in relation to Raphael's talk last night, which he referred to as something defining of his practice and the moving image. I don't know if you have more to say about the way in which the qualities of light define what is the cinematic.
Well, it up until the appearance of video, light was an essential component of the moving image experience. The beam of light was critical. It no longer is, and yet there is something I find irresistible to artists about the notion of light and of making light an essential property of their of their art.
So. And of course, since the 1920s, shortly after the inception of cinema, with the inception of television, there's always been moving image that don't involve projection in the same way,
right. But
light in a different form that works then on the optical apparatus in a different form. And this is something that some filmmakers are very interested in the difference between celluloid and video is actually physiologically the difference between what a continuous presentation of light through mm-hmm. celluloid, what effects that operates on the eye compared to the digital
right.
medium and an intermittent package of information.
Yes. Well, we recently had what was fascinating for me is that I, as someone who grew up and was informed by the cinematic, the light experience, resisting the electronic. However, just last week or before I got on the plane to Adelaide, I screened at the museum the Academy Award-nominated short documentaries. We do this as a service because no one ever will get to see them otherwise. And we basically picked the copies that the New York branch of the Academy sees. They then bring them to the museum. And at one point, there were four works. I was told three of the works, one would be HD cam, one would be digibeta, the other would be beta SP, and one would be 35 millimeter. But it turns out that the three works that I was told were going to be on video were on hard drives. So we had to bring in a server and the whole, and it was very interesting, and they looked spectacular. Because I had seen one of the works on DVD before, and it really looked poor. But now it looked extraordinarily professional, clear, precise. Interesting to compare those three stunning pieces, I mean, visually, I'm not talking about their making, or with the 35 millimeter film, which almost, I had to say, looked old-fashioned in spite of my enthusiasm for the medium. It wasn't as clear, it wasn't as precise. Maybe it had more depth, though, because with every bit of clarity that video is able, or the electronic image is able to produce, I think there's a certain depth or romance lost for me. But I don't know for anyone, I don't know for the younger generation.
Should I start passing this on?
I find that interesting in terms of the judgments of clarity and precision and those sort of aesthetic judgments, like, do you rate paintings in the same way?
Is that necessarily? No,
I'm reacting to simply this medium as a moving image medium. I would never want to rate paintings in the same with the same set of standards as I do. I mean, this, ultimately, yes, but in terms of depth and clarity, I think each medium has its own. Its own advantages, its own set of coordinates. I happen to prefer more of the romance and the mystery of film, or I thought I did up until recently. But it is an aesthetic judgment, and it is informed as much by my biography as by my critical eye, as I think most critical judgments are.
Yeah, like there's the embracing the pixel and embracing the corruption and embracing, which is a whole other stream of...
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose I don't really want to go there for a whole lot of reasons. But, Larry, I wanted to thank you for setting out some of those, the big issues that we're facing in regard to the relationship between cinema, video, the digital, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to pick up just where you were leaving off around the question of what you referred to, or was what I remember in my head, as laptop cinema. And one of the problematics that you didn't mention, perhaps your sixth problematic, is... what do we do with works as far as their representation and accessibility via networks and display on the web? And what are you thinking about that in terms of preservation and exhibition at MoMA?
Well, that is another problematic, and I just it's a whole other field, but and yet it isn't. We have. Thanks to our curator, who's very fluent in this, Barbara London, acquired some websites working that out, and some games made by artists as well. This is still very much. In evolution, where the museum is not ignoring it, but it is such an evolving field, it is difficult to kind of pin down at the moment. But in terms of people making narrative cinema, quote. For laptops and for the internet, that's another issue as well. And if some of these works distinguish themselves, they can be acquired, quote unquote.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question about the number of works that you have in the film collection, and also. How you work with your younger department, the new media department?
But well, we have about 20,000 works of film and moving image works. The media department is an evolution of the film department, and the curators who work in the media department. All worked in the film department until recently. We work very closely together, and there are we talk together, not all the time, but most of the times about acquisitions, because let me put it this way: not all media is moving image, okay, or now media is also performance art. But, of course, performance art becomes significant. One of the questions about performance art is how do you archive performance art? Through recordings. Then you deal with moving images. Not only recordings, but notes and paperwork, drawings, which was also acquired by the Department of Media. But the answer is we work very closely together, and we were one curatorial department at one time. Now, it's interesting because of the fluidity and the plasticity of practice in contemporary art, every curator in the museum is encouraged to look at whatever art excites him or her, no matter what department it covers. For instance, we have someone in photography we have something called the Fund for the 21st Century, which is a fund that, funded by the certain trustees at the museum who are interested in the most contemporary work. And several times a year, curators make proposals for acquisitions. And you can do this no matter what department you're in. For instance, someone in photography is going to be recommending a video acquisition very, very shortly. Of course, this has to come with the assent and agreement of the department, but it doesn't have to emanate. It doesn't have to originate from that department. And so all of us at the museum are now encouraged to think globally in terms of taxonomy, you know, of the museum.
From an artist filmmaker's perspective, it was very encouraging to hear you say that you don't necessarily encourage artists to edition their work. We're lefties, and we believe that our responsibility is to humanity, not to collectors, mm-hmm. And certainly to not make work with any sense of making it for exclusive enjoyment. Mm-hmm. It surprised me to hear you say that so openly. And
And it's very interesting because we even have to educate our trustees who are very sophisticated and sharp, because on some occasion they'll say, you know, you want to buy this work and it's only, you know, say $2,000. Does this mean it's, you know, why is it only that? And you have to say, because it's not, you know, perhaps it's not additioned. If it were additioned, it might be, you know, multiples of that. So there's always a little tiny resistance, but then they say, oh, great.
Do you find that sometimes popularity of a work within the public domain is an incentive for you to then pursue an artist and collect their work? That is, if an artist releases their work publicly, either on DVD or online perhaps, and there's a warm public reception for it, does that give you an incentive to potentially?
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Hi. I just want to sort of add to this comment. I mean, I'm a lefty too, and I do edition my work. And I just want to say why I do it. I edition it because some of my work, actually, I don't edition all of my work, but some of it, as a lefty, I'm very concerned with the format in which the piece is actually viewed. And I find that that institutions like MoMA might be able to respect very stringent, very specific limitations on how the particular piece is viewed. So I just want to sort of say, you know, that this way of reducing the number of copies that are out there is a way to actually guarantee the fidelity of what your vision is. Whereas other works, you know, you may want to just sort of open it up. And on the question I wanted to ask you if you were at liberty to tell us who the artist who you were sort of mentioning, you had second thoughts on having purchased the edition.
No, I can't answer that.
What was that? It wasn't me. Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. No, that would be indiscreet.
Yeah, I also wanted to say one other thing in defense of editioning, which is that a lot of the times what you find with collectors that are buying editioned video work is that they're really kind of working on behalf of the artist to make that work get out there, because, I mean, there is like a profit incentive, I suppose, for those collectors, because having the work be seen does increase its value. But I think a lot of times the reason why a collector buys an edition video work is less because they think that they will ever sell it again, because, you know, DVD does really poorly at auction most of the time. But more because they really believe in that work and it's a way of supporting it. So in a way, like for an artist that doesn't have a big audience, editioning your work can be a way of actually building support and making it more accessible in a kind of in a funny way. So the logic actually can work in support of getting it.
Oh, sure. No, I think artists have to live. And there's no, but for me, there is always a tension between, you know, a work of cinema that is editioned and the need of the artist to earn a living. But of course, I mean, if that is a way of earning a living, that's the way of earning a living. You have to put food on the table.
But I think a lot of times editioned work is selling for like $3,000 or something as well. And
Not the ones I'm familiar with.
Well, I mean, it does depend very much on the artist. But I think for an emerging artist to create an edition of five and get your work into a collector's hands, that will kind of work on your behalf.
But, you know, there's sometimes when I approach someone who's made a film, the artist didn't have the idea that the work would end up in a collector's hand. It's like it's like the first suggestion that I have to make, because I have to go back to our trustees and say this is an edition or not an edition. And again, and the decision has to come from the artist, and the artist says, what do you mean? And I have to, you know, explain it. And then they go and they think, do I want to edition it? Do I don't want to edition it? What does it mean? Because eventually, if the decision is to edition it, this, you know, it comes with a contract. The artist then is, or his gallery or her gallery is obliged to fulfill that contract and not have more copies made at a certain quality, I guess.
I'm a programmer at a film archive, and I'm interested about these ideas. You talk very much about contemporary work and respect particularly for the attention of the artist in the gallery space. But the unique position of MoMA, of course, is that it is a film collection that's evolved in a way into an artist's video collection as well, or an artist's filmmaking collection as well. So it's both a collection for the cinema and for the gallery space. Now,
Some for both.
Yeah, and some for both, of course. But I think a lot of us who work with films, the curation of film heritage, mm-hmm. are concerned about issues about how cinema or film is being welcomed into the gallery, particularly the sometimes not always attentive practices of gallery curators to screening material retrospectively, screening material in the wrong format, screening material digitally inherently, which of course has been a problem back to the time when carbon arc disappeared or we could no longer see things straight off the negative. So your unease about, or your kind of uncertainty now about the romanticism of 35mm, does that possibly apply retrospectively if you want to show a Murnau film or a John Ford film?
We will only show, in our theatres, we will only show the original material, unless the original material, so if the work is made in 35, we'll show a 35 print. We would not, by choice, show a digital restoration unless there isn't the material anymore. And the copyright holders insist that we show the digital restoration. Right? Don't go there. We preserved Eraserhead. We have a negative. And this is a case in which the artist said the digital restoration is better than my original. We're not going to argue with the artist, but we do have the original.
We're now in a similar situation with all the documentaries, especially the documentary film,
screen, DVD. Right. We also have, you're talking about, using films within galleries that were not meant for gallery exhibition. We really took a firm position on this, our department. And we said, no, you can't use excerpts from this or that, put in the galleries. And this came about when Herzog and de Meuron, the architects, were doing a project for MoMA, and they wanted to take, it was an artist's choice, so they used the collection from of the museum. And they wanted to make this kind of church which was difficult to see. They constructed an architectural environment, and out of wood, and through slats you could see pieces of the collection, pieces of paintings, pieces of the industrial design collection. And on the roof, they wanted to project images of sex and violence from the cinema, from our collection. We were outraged, the administration of the museum said, this is what these artists want to do. We have to go through the process of trying to make this happen. So we came up with the idea that they would not have access to any work by artists who are dead. Okay? So, but if they want, they really didn't want artists who were dead anyway. They wanted to show violence from, you know, Scorsese, the Coen brothers, the more popular works. So we said that the artist should write to the living artists whose films are in the collection, get their approval, and then the museum would have to go to the studios, the copyright holders. We would not allow our films, this is even internal, to be duplicated for this. But if the artists could get the permission of the filmmakers, then fine, we have no objection. And we thought this will kill the project. This will kill it. Because you know how Marty Scorsese is with the film market. No one said no. Everyone said yes, and they got the studios to provide the thing. So we were kind of gobsmacked, and we lost our battle. But that's, you know, people want to be shown at the museum, or they don't mind their works being presented in this way.
Because in a sense, that's what you're doing now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And these are fragments, while
yes,
still from 25 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, these are decontextualized. I mean,
yes, I was just showing you part of that. I just wanted to give you an idea of the collection.
But the question is, you know, what's the problem with that?
Oh, there's a lot of problems with that. I don't even give you captions here.
Yeah. Actually, it gets even more problematic because the difference between production still and frame and
art. Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, and there was one in the Pipilotti Riest, which is an installation. I mean, it makes no sense. You have to be in the installation. Of course, it is an acquisition as well. Isaac's film.
So we're actually at okay. 5 minutes over already, and Julianne was suggesting we take a 5-minute break before coming back to hear Isaac Julianne in conversation with Conrad Bodman. If you just first join me in thanking Larry very much for his presentation.